The gospel reading from John chapter 11 continues. Now, Jesus had not yet come to the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. And the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary get up quickly and go out, and they followed her, because they thought she was going to the tomb to weep there. And when Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she knelt at his feet and said to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply moved. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." And Jesus began to weep. And so the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" And then Jesus, again greatly disturbed, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was lying against it. And Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, already there is a stench. He has been dead 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. And Jesus looked upward and said, "Father, I thank you for having heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I have said this for the sake of the crowd standing here, so that they may believe that you sent me." And when he said this, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." And the dead man came out, his hands and feet bound with strips of cloth, and his face wrapped in a cloth. And Jesus said to them, "Unbind him and let him go." And many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what Jesus did, believed in him. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. It gives me no pleasure to tell you this, but it is a historical fact that once upon a time, at the tender age of 18 years old, I joined a fraternity, Sigma Phi Epsilon to be specific, and I could still give you the secret handshake 15 years later, but of course I will not, because it is a secret. I think it's abundantly clear at this point that I'm not really fraternity material, but maybe that was less obvious to me or anyone else back in 1998, what with my swooping bangs and seashell necklaces and deep desire to have friends. So I rushed Sigma Phi Epsilon, and to my amazement and my parents' dismay, I received a bid to join. And on the first day of the pledging season, I reported to the fraternity house in my button-down shirt and my tie, not at all sure what I was getting into. And all of the pledges were lined up outside the house in a row, and inside the house were 60 more brothers, and there was this loud pounding music and some kind of weird screaming, and I tried not to appear as nervous as I felt, and it seemed to me like the other pledges were doing the same, and we just stood there waiting until one at a time they called our name and we would walk forward and go through the front door, and no one was coming back. And when my name was called, I stepped out of the line and I walked to the front door, and inside there was this sea of faces, and everyone was yelling and the music was very loud, and I was pushed down a hallway into a large room where there were brothers all around the perimeter, but the center of the room was empty like a runway. And I was standing there like someone who was expected to kick a field goal. And then an older brother came and he put his arm around my shoulder and he put his face very close to my ear so that I could hear him. And he said, "When we say go, we want you to run at full speed across this room and then jump down that flight of steps." And he pointed to the stairwell at the other side of the room. And I couldn't see beyond the first step, but I was familiar with that staircase. I knew it was at least 20 steps. "Are you ready?" he cried out. "No," I replied. "Okay, let's start the countdown," he said. I said, "I am not ready," I yelled. And it wasn't clear if they couldn't hear me or if they were just ignoring me. 10, 9, 8, the whole room was cheering for me. And I wish I could tell you that I exercised my right to say no. 18 years of excellent parenting should have told me that hazing is hazing, and I did not have to comply, and I could have turned around right then and there and walked out the door. 7, 6, 5, My heart was pounding out of my chest. 4, 3, 2, 1. And I rushed across the room like my life depended on it, and I reached the edge of the staircase and I leapt. And by the time that both of my feet were in the air, I could see what I hoped to be true, that the entire bottom third of the staircase was full of mattresses and pillows, and I landed in them like a bag of laundry. And after each of us had taken the leap and were pulled out of the pillows and reassembled in the fraternity basement, we were given a very serious speech about trusting the house and fully committing to the process and just taking the leap into the sacred brotherhood of Sigma Phi Epsilon. Would we trust the fraternity with our very lives, asked a very intense sophomore. No, I thought to myself. Just a month earlier, someone had broken their arm falling out of their own bedroom window. So no, I do not trust you. And please don't hear this sermon as an endorsement of hazing or fraternity life in any fashion, but I have been thinking about 18-year-old me and why I did that. Why was I even there in the first place? Even as I found the fraternity ridiculous, I could not deny this. I was hungry for friends that were worth dying for. I was hungry for experiences that were going to push me beyond the boring boundaries of myself. And so when my time came and my name was called, I sprinted into the unknown and I jumped. There are so many ways that we could talk about this Lazarus text. It is so long and so complex and important. It is obviously a pretty dramatic piece of foreshadowing. Jesus' years in ministry follow this pattern of escalation, especially as John tells the story. His travels have taken him through small towns in Galilee and Judea, into Jericho, and back towards Jerusalem. And his teaching and preaching and miracles have caused the crowds to get bigger and bigger, and they have ratcheted up the tension between Jesus and the religious and political authorities. And at least as John's gospel tells it, this story, the raising of Lazarus, is the hinge on which the whole narrative turns. It's worth noting, as always, that while John is pointed in his use of the term the Jews, this label includes the large crowd of mourners gathered around Mary and Martha, those who believed in Jesus and those who did not. Presumably, it also included Jesus and Mary and Martha themselves. But some of those who witnessed the miraculous raising of Lazarus reported it to the authorities. What are we to do? The chief priests asked themselves behind closed doors. This man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and destroy both our holy place and our nation. From that day onward, verse 53 says, they planned to put him to death. There is an anti-Semitic reading of the text to be had here, if one is not careful, but to me there is also a much more universal application. It is a very human thing to build systems and beliefs and strategies into our life to cope with the fact that we simply do not know what will happen to us when we leave the room or the door each day. And when someone disrupts those systems, those beliefs, those strategies, even with the promise of resurrection, there is a part of us that recoils from that. I hear that voice in the anxious huddle of the priests, and believe me, I hear it also in Christian gatherings and neighborhood associations and boardrooms. It is a very human thing. But the authorities were unnerved by signs of life where they only expected death. And they worried, probably correctly, that such an unvarnished resurrection would lead many to believe in Jesus' power, and that a revelation might lead to a revolution. And they worried, again correctly, that such a revolution could end very badly for Israel. And it was the uncertainty, the lack of control, that was unbearable for them. Drawing so close to new life might not be worth it. And it's funny, Mary and Martha have a similar fear, but it is much more relatable. Jesus asks them to roll back the stone of the tomb where their brother's unembalmed corpse is sealed away. And unlike the religious authorities, the sisters are desperate to see a resurrection. They would give anything to have their brother walking and talking and breathing again. But it is also the uncertainty that unnerves them. Their brother's death has broken their hearts, but at least now it is contained. To open the tomb again is not simply to expose them just to terrible sights and smells. It is also to open their hearts to the possibility of resurrection. And who really could bear the disappointment if that didn't bear out? Drawing so close to death, they worry, might not be worth it. And it's a funny thing, you know, meditating on the death and resurrection of Lazarus with Easter right around the corner. What does it mean? Is the raising of Lazarus equivalent to a super healing, like the healing of the blind man, but more comprehensive? Or is it a prologue to Jesus' own resurrection, a miracle of a different order? I'm inclined towards the latter, because Lazarus is going to die again. No one seems to suggest otherwise. More than anything, his resurrection seems to be less of a theological project and more like something that just comes straight out of Jesus' gut. Jesus proclaims to be the resurrection for all people, new life, more powerful than death, but look at his face. He's weeping. He is deeply disturbed in his soul. He goes to such lengths to bring Lazarus back for even just a few more years. Why? I think it's because even when you are the resurrection, death sucks. It matters that Jesus feels this way about Lazarus because it signals to us that the knowledge of the promises of resurrection does not give us a pass when it comes to walking through the valley of the shadow of death. And in fact, the valley of the shadow of death might be an essential passage. So we hold a space for faith. We proclaim Christ's promise, but we still navigate that bitter reality which comes to each of us sooner or later. I came back from spring break that first year of college as a freshly minted, freshly initiated brother of Sigma Phi Epsilon. I had summoned the courage to leap into the unknown. I had submitted to various indignities. I had repeated the solemn pledges of brotherhood with a mostly straight face. I had learned the sacred secrets of, if not the universe, at least the tired old binder of rituals that was locked in a closet on the second floor of the house. I came back from spring break that freshman year of college to learn that one of my new fraternity brothers had drowned in a kayaking accident on the Gali River. And the news was delivered by our president in this weird and shaky voice in that same basement at the bottom of the steps. We were stunned. And two things were immediately clear to me. The first, that the rituals and traditions of the fraternity had nothing to offer us in the face of this tragedy. And second, the man, Chris, who had drowned, was, in a very real and heartbreaking sense, my brother. I wasn't able to attend the funeral, but there was a memorial service at the Presbyterian Church on campus. We walked to the sanctuary as a house in blazers and ties and listened to the minister recite to us the promises of Jesus. And I can't remember his exact words, but I'm sure it was something along the lines of, "I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die." And here is an irony. The pledging process, the rituals, the talk of brotherhood, the leap into the darkness, that was all just play acting compared to the experience of walking that valley together. It was a farce that at best approximated the very real and powerful thing that none of us would have ever signed up for. And look, I'm not trying to suggest that everyone there believed it or that things were forever different. But my God, I will not soon forget how it felt that day, walking across campus in a solemn line, when I realized with some surprise from my grief that this was the connection, the brotherhood that I had been hungry for. Here is a hard truth brought to you and me, courtesy of Lazarus. There is no real resurrection without real death. Healing, sure. Encouragement, without a doubt. But resurrection, the miracle of heart-pounding, tomb-opening new life, is the final act of a three-act play with a very difficult middle passage. It's something that none of us cares to sit through. And we who claim the promises of the gospel have a powerful message of hope to share with the world, a message of love that transcends suffering, a message of life that transcends death. That is Easter, and I claim it for so many people right here in this room, people in my life, people who are bravely dealing with cancer or divorce or disappointment or the memories of people that they love. The promises of the gospel are real. But there is this temptation, I think, to try and get there by skating across the top of the human experience, by minimizing our struggles, by suggesting that everything is fine. We, like those anxious priests, huddle in secret meetings, wondering how we're going to keep it all going like solid people of faith, the people we feel like we need to be. And what I hear Jesus saying, his eyes full of tears, is that we can let that go. What I hear Jesus saying is that we need to move closer to the tomb. We need to be brave enough to open the door to resurrection, and there is no way to do that without confronting the realities of death. It is no more or less than the hard work of being a real human being who loves and is loved in the face of incredible uncertainty. Imagine how powerful it would be if we could be the church that walks down that road together, sisters and brothers in the company of a God who will go there too, telling the truth, stepping out of the shadows, unbinding those previously believed to be dead, bringing signs of resurrection, not just for that great getting up morning, friends, but for right here and right now. So the question I have for you during this call and response season of Lent is there a place in your world where you hear Jesus calling you to step out a little bit further than you care to go? In a relationship or your work or your sense of calling, is there a place where you are being invited to embrace the uncertainty and follow Jesus out?